Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing use of refugees as bargaining chips following the deal between Turkey and the EU, with countries like Niger extorting $1.2 billion to stop the flow of refugees into Libya and the Mediterranean, and Kenya threatening to close down the massive Dadaab camp of refugees, then deporting 600,000 Somalis back to their war-torn country. Joining us is James Jennings, founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the 2011 Somali famine in Dadaab and is now working in Lesbos, Greece, where today there were riots as desperate Syrian refugees faced deportation back to Turkey. We'll discuss the fate of 60 million refugees worldwide and what the UN-sponsored World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul later this month will address and possibly achieve. Then, with the wildfires in Canada now heading towards the oil sands mines in Alberta, forcing the evacuation of thousands of workers, we will speak with Dr. Toddy Steelman, the Executive Director and Professor at the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Saskatchewan. She joins us to discuss the worsening turn in what is Canada's costliest natural disaster and the central role of climate change in fueling wildfires that is not only making these vast boreal forest fires more deadly, but more frequent as well. Then finally, on the 100th anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement that divided up the Middle East between France and Britain at the end of World War II as the Ottoman Empire collapsed, we will speak with James Paul, the author of Syria Unmasked. He was executive director of the Global Policy Forum and a longtime editor of the Oxford Companion to Politics of the World. And he joins us to discuss how the map that spawned a century of resentment is now in flames as the unitary states of Iraq and Syria are embroiled in war and face disintegration as smaller marginalized ethnic groups either form states or face extinction. And joining us now is James Jennings, the founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010-2011 in the giant Dadaab camp for Somalian refugees in Kenya. Previously, he taught Middle East history at several universities, including the University of Illinois. And for more information about Conscience International, you can go to conscienceinternational.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Jennings.
Thank you.
And the idea that the Kenyan government is threatening to close this giant Dadaab camp, which I believe is the biggest refugee camp in the world, in spite of the enormous refugee camps that have sprung up in Jordan and Lebanon as a result of the wars in Iraq and Syria. You've been to this camp. So, I mean, what are they going to do with all those people that you can't return them to Somalia, as the Kenyan government is threatening to do, because it's completely unstable, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. The war in Somalia continues. The civil war has been going on for many years there, but the latest phase of it since 2009. What I think is significant is that within a year after that started, almost half of Somalia's population fled their homes, and so the population, nobody knows how many are in Somalia exactly, but it's estimated between 6 and 8 million people there. And so many of them came into Ethiopia and Kenya because those were closest places. And then when the famine struck, it was even worse in 2011. So the European Union, I was with their commissioner when we went there, and we surveyed all of the camps. There are actually four or five of them now within 30-kilometer radius, Dadaab, Ifo, Degale, Hadegera, and then they've had others since. Well, as the author of a piece reviewing the book about this in the New York Times just recently said, there were 300,000 in 2010, and now it's estimated about 600,000.
Well, clearly, since the deal was made between the EU and Turkey to turn back refugees that have been fleeing from Turkey, originally from Syria into Turkey, and then across the Aegean into Greece, usually to the island of Lesbos. And of course, many have drowned on the way, and we've seen graphic and heartbreaking pictures of dead children, etc. But the deal was made, and now there's riots going on in Lesbos. But it sounds as if what's happened is that this deal has led to refugees, in effect, becoming bargaining chips. The government of the West African country of Niger demanded about $1.2 billion from the European Union to stop migrants on their way to Libya and the Mediterranean, etc. So, and this seems to be what Kenya is doing in terms of the Dadaab camp. They're basically saying, you know, pay us, because, and of course, Kenya, in all fairness, is not a rich country. So is this what's going on here, that refugees are becoming bargaining chips?
Yes, indeed. I think correctly so. I always think that you have to step back and look at the larger picture when you have such a complex situation. There are 60 million refugees in the world. And when those countries like Syria or Iraq or Somalia are dysfunctional, then they're caused by violence in the country, and then to add a drought or a famine on top of that is just incredible. And so people flee to wherever they can get help. Now, it also is about money. And the when I was there, the European Union had already put 40 million euros into that situation, and they have to keep doing it. So when they say we don't want to do it anymore, that's about money. It's not about compassion exactly. And then the countries involved usually try to keep these people under wraps, away from their cities, their centers of population, and it becomes almost like a concentration camp of sorts. Now, Dadaab is not just one camp, as I said. It's five or six and several more by now. But we drove for 30 kilometers around and ate a lot of dust to get from one section to another. The habitations are extremely pathetic and bad. Just sticks usually stuck in the sand with something, a piece of plastic over them or whatever. Blankets, and the people's lives are miserable. Now, that can be compared to other situations. I would say that it's almost as bad in the southern part of Ethiopia, where we worked at a huge Boko Mayo camp, and there are 5, 6, 7 camps there, all of which are holding like 80,000 each of the Somalis coming in. So the international organizations and the non-governmental organizations are struggling to deal with this on a daily basis. And if the money isn't forthcoming, then the people's lives are affected. So the solution is always to stabilize the political situation in the country so the people can go back home. Most of the Syrians want to go back, for example. And these people in Somalia, they would prefer going back and having their agricultural life and raising cattle and so forth than being where they are now. And you could say the same about Darfur, which has been such a terrible situation in the south of Sudan for so many years.
So, but in terms of the idea of trying to stabilize countries like Syria so that the people can return, let's deal with stabilizing Somalia. I mean, the Kenyans and the other African countries, under the aegis of the U.S. and with the urging of the U.S. and with support from the U.S., invaded Somalia for that particular reason. That was at least the stated reason, which was to stabilize the country, and that certainly has not worked out. And the Kenyan forces have been involved in all kinds of corruption, etc. So if that's what we're depending upon, that's not going to happen. So these poor people in this camp that are about to be kicked out by the Kenyan government really have nowhere to go. And so you ask yourself, well, what was all that money spent on a military option that hasn't worked? Who was actually paying for the upkeep of these refugees at Dadaab?
Well, the European Union and the UN, and the U.S., of course, is the biggest contributor to the UN and its humanitarian programs all over the world. And so it comes out of the pockets of the wealthier nations. And it seems to me that the attitude, unfortunately, is that these people are not needed on Earth, and they're sort of the off-scouring of the Earth, and they need to stay where they are, and we can pay a little bit of money to them and as in way of food, as guilt money. It almost seems that way sometimes. Keep them out of sight. But when you talk about closing that camp, that is a total impossibility unless there's a ability to suction them back into the country where they were based on stable conditions there. And as you say, that's not happening. So it's really dreadful, and I fear that the fallout, of course, as we've seen a lot of it, is terrorism. For example, the Garissa massacre, which killed 148 students in a school in Kenya, and the al-Shabaab offshoot of al-Qaeda is active still in Somalia and the surrounding areas. So, but you know, the United States has put a great deal of effort in terms of the military into Somalia. If you analyze the drone attacks that Mr. Obama has authorized, many of them, most I think, more than in Syria and Iraq, have been in Somalia. So, the U.S. is actively at war and has been there for a long time, and it's pretty much a secret war, not much in the news, public consciousness, but it's an attempt to keep the lid on an explosive situation. But we have that in Afghanistan, we have it in the Middle East, and we have it in East Africa as well, and of course in Central Africa, Nigeria, and Congo as well, and Uganda. All those countries are affected by Boko Haram and the other militant organizations.
Well, James Jennings, though, your organization, I believe, Conscious Internationals, is involved in helping the Syrian and Iraqi and Afghan refugees in Lesbos, the island of Lesbos, which has been the point where refugees from Turkey, Syrian refugees largely, make that hazardous journey and are sort of caught there in limbo now because a deal was struck with the EU and Turkey to return these refugees back to Turkey. And in fact, I just saw some news reports of how Syrian refugees, particularly young boys and girls, are being exploited in sweatshop labor, etc., by the Turks. So it's not just a humanitarian disaster that these people face, but they also face exploitation. They also, many drowned because they spent money that they could ill afford on phony life jackets that didn't work, etc. Your organization is there on the ground in Lesbos. I understand there were riots there today. What's the situation?
Yes, Ian, you're right. I was on the phone this morning with our camp supervisor there in Lesbos, and he was actually injured by the rioters and also by the tear gas and explosions that the police implemented. So we're concerned about him. But that's the camp that the Pope visited recently, and he is in charge of supervising the workers, the volunteer workers there in the camp. And it's you know, the tension is so tremendous for these people, and you can't blame them of their frustration, but they do get out of hand from time to time. So far as we know, that situation is manageable, but we've been working for months rescuing these people from the water and then helping them to either go on or stay there into Europe or stay there in the camp. Right now, they're not going on. The other thing is that I had a meeting last night with the Turkish ambassador, and we talked about the stress on the Turkish government for dealing with all the people who are 2.5 million Syrian and Iraqi refugees and migrants in Turkey. And I think that Turkey is going to do the best that they can. They do need help. And so we've been working in Turkey as well with some of the camps and some of the urban areas. And we hope to do more there.
So what do you think is going to come out of this international world humanitarian summit that the United Nations is sponsoring? It's a conference that will be held later this month in Istanbul.
It really comes down to money. Who will put money forward to help not solve these problems, but alleviate them temporarily? But in a way, some of the countries feel that they're being held into blackmail, that that they have to pay, or else other problems will occur. That's true, but again, the world leaders are aware that unless the problems are solved in the home countries, that they have to deal with these problems. And I think if you had to say anything about what the concern is, it's the future, and that is the children that are being unable to go to school. They will not learn how to read in Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. The refugees will be unable to get a job except something very menial, and they will be on the dole, or they will be seduced by the militant organizations, the terrorists, who will give them a gun and say, let's solve this problem and you can help us. And that is dreadful to think about, and is why we're concerned to try to implement starting schools, getting education for them in one way or another, as well as the humanitarian. Now, the humanitarian part is giving food and water and blankets and shelter and medicine to people who are in need. The other part is the more and more being realized by the UN these days is psychosocial trauma therapy. Every one of these people has suffered trauma. Last summer, we were in northern Iraq with 168 teenagers who had been driven out by ISIS from their homes, and they are suffering trauma every day that they wake up. So dealing with that trauma is important. We just had a meeting today about a team of counselors who will be going there for us in July to Greece, and we'll be counseling with the refugee family. So it's really an important part of humanitarian work.
Well, James Jennings, I mean, just in closing, it would seem obviously one needs to find a way to end the war in Syria, to end the war in Somalia, to end the war in Nigeria. And ever since the U.S. invaded Iraq, that entire region in the Middle East has been in chaos. And then on top of that, of course, the violent ideology that you're talking about that preys upon these young, uneducated people that's stuck in these camps has been exported for some time by Saudi Wahhabism. So there are causes that are identifiable, but at this point, we just seem to be sort of throwing money at the result of the problem rather than solving the core of the problem.
Yes, and looking forward, I think we have to have high-level peace conferences that deal with the real issues. And we have held some of these in Iran and Iraq and Syria and Sudan and Lebanon, Jordan in the past. We want to hold such meetings in Turkey now to have U.S. Professors who are political scientists, specialists in Islam, and other subjects who will contribute their expertise to help solve some of these problems, and especially in terms of future planning for peace. So that's another aspect that we would like to do if funding is available.
Well, James Jennings, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010-2011 in the giant Dadaab camp for Somalian refugees in Kenya. Previously, he taught Middle East history at several universities, including the University of Illinois. And for more information on Conscience International, you can go to conscienceinternational.org. We're going to take a brief station break and be back discussing the worsening turn in Canada's costliest natural disaster as the wildfires now head towards the oil sands mines in Alberta.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger. That bright land to which I go, I'm going there to see my mother.
Incinerate, incinerate.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Toddy Stillman, who's Executive Director and Professor at the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Saskatchewan, whose research interests include environmental and natural resource governance, public and community decision-making, the interface between science, policy, and decision-making, climate change adaptation, disaster-resilient communities, risk and crisis communication, and wildfire preparedness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toddy Stillman.
Thank you so very much.
And clearly this wildfire in Alberta, going back in recent history, these things tend to go on. Some of the, I believe there were wildfires that went on for the entire month of the fire season and were only put out by the winter snows. So this fire seemed to be sort of somewhat waning because of weather, but now there's been a change in the weather, and now it's reignited and heading, I believe, north towards the tar sands facilities. So at this point, what's your understanding about what is being threatened here?
As I understand it, the fire is headed north, and it's looking towards, I think, some of the, as you sort of said, some of the oil sands facilities that are up to the north. So that would probably include the Suncor facilities.
Well, the Suncor facility apparently is being closed, and so far the fire has cost the Canadian economy close to $1 billion Canadian, and apparently they were just going back to work and now they've had to be evacuated again. So what could be the interface between a wildfire and this facility? What's at stake there? It seems like just on the surface, if you're mining for bitumen, which is highly flammable, this could be an explosive situation.
Absolutely. And I think probably what's at most risk right now is that the work camps have been evacuated. So I think around 8,000 people have been evacuated from the work camps. I think the challenge is, like you said, so there's the oil sands facilities are flammable. So I think that's worry. But that said, the companies usually do an enormous amount of risk management around those facilities. It's the work camps, I think, that people are worried about right now and evacuating the people. So at least that is my understanding. I think the fire that was closer to Fort McMurray last week and the week prior, the big concern there is that, a large wildland urban interface fire that was in the city, you know, previously is going to also have a very high economic toll in terms of people being out of their houses, continuing to be evacuated, not having a workforce around, and not having services available as well. So I think there are both direct as well as indirect potential costs as Fort McMurray continues to be evacuated.
And in terms of the work that you have done, you have been warning for some time, I take it, Dr. Stillman, about this sort of dangerous combination of climate change and wildfires.
Well, and it's not just me. I mean, I think it's fairly well known that there is a connection between rising temperatures, which, you know, rising temperatures globally are affiliated with rising greenhouse gases that we're seeing. And then whenever we see rising temperatures, we also see increases in wildland fire activity. So the thing that we have to be looking at is as greenhouse gas intensity increases, we see rising temperature. And as we see rising temperature, we see increased wildfire activity. So that's the connection. And in some ways, that's just basic physics. We've also seen in Australia, in Canada, and in the United States a lengthening of the wildfire season. So wildfire season is many days longer now than it used to be historically, and that is also correlated with rising temperatures. So there are big changes basically that we're seeing not just in Canada, not just in the United States, but also in Australia that leads us to believe that it is a climate impact.
Well, as you know, the tar sands facilities in Canada have been something of a political football here in the United States, particularly over the issue of the pipeline to take this heavy crude bitumen from Alberta down to the refineries on the Texas coast in the Gulf. And the Keystone XL pipeline has been an extremely contentious issue. For example, the climate scientist at NASA, Dr. Hansen, said if the Canadian tar sand are fully developed, it's game over for the environment. So isn't there a huge paradox here that you're talking about the effects of global warming from CO2, and the very site of this fire is where so much of the this carbon that is about to be burned once it's processed into fuel is deposited?
Well, I mean, I think it would not just be the tar sands, right? I mean, the whole global economy contributes in many ways to rising greenhouse gas concentrations. So
right.
I think there's a, you know, I think that it's, there are lots of sources of it. And I think it would be wrong to conclude that, you know, what's happening, the fires in Fort McMurray right now are, you know, directly connected to what's happening with the oil sands, right? I mean, fossil fuels have to be burned. Those greenhouse gases have to sort of be loaded into the atmosphere, and it's that sort of process that sort of contributes to the warming of the atmosphere. So I think that, yes, does the oil sands, as someone who produces, you know, a fossil fuel, contribute to this? Yes. But, you know, no more than oil and gas facilities that we'd see in the United States, or the car that you and I drive, or the many other sort of, contributions that we have for creating energy, whether it's a coal-fired power plant or some other sort of, you know, fossil fuel-based source of energy.
No, one's certainly not holding Canada or the Alberta tar sands up as an example of what's of the cause of global warming. There's so many other contributions, but it just struck me as an irony that we're talking about Mother Nature reacting to a man-made climate change is now threatening a part of the world where there's a vast deposit of dirty fuel, and of course the stationary coal plants, etc. As you know, there's an election today in Kentucky that's hinging rather very much upon whether Hillary Clinton is going to be able to recover from letting the people in coal country know that their days are numbered. These are some of the complexities and realities that we're dealing with. But
absolutely,
you know, so
yeah.
And given that we've lost, I mean, the Canadian economy has lost about close to $1 billion, and the Alberta economy, which depends even more on it, has lost $763 million. This is clearly a real trauma for the local community.
Well, I think the Fort McMurray fires are probably going to be the most costly natural disaster in Canada's history, certainly the most costly wildfire disaster that they've ever seen. And so at least the estimates that I've seen from BMO Canada have put it between probably $2 to $6 billion, and I'm thinking that's probably a conservative estimate at this point. So it's by far one of the largest and most costly, the most costly natural disaster, certainly, that in Canada's history at this stage.
So in terms of the Canadian economy then, how do you deal with this situation of these wildfires? As we mentioned, there have been previous fires that have just simply these boreal forests can burn for all the way through to the winter. There's a lot of peat involved, I understand, and that's extremely flammable and can burn even through the winter. Is there anything that can be done, short of getting real about climate change?
Well, I mean, I think right now, given the size of the fire and the current weather conditions, what you're looking at is for what we call a weather-ending event. So heavy rains would certainly have an impact on the fire in terms of, you know, putting it out, or at least changing the intensity of it. It is, given where we are in fire season, we're still in very early days of fire season, so it could burn all season long. And as you indicated, and I'm not sure about where the peat is up there. I'm not an expert on peat and where that exactly is located. But once fires do get into that carbon-rich soil, it can burn for quite some time. So that is also worrisome. I'm just not as familiar with that geology in that region. So I can't speak to that. But I think that the size of the fire and the current weather conditions suggest that what we are waiting for at this stage is a weather-ending event.
But some of your previous writings, you, Dr. Stearman, have suggested that global, if we don't wake up to global warming, it's going to kick our butt. So that seems to be happening on all fronts. Specifically, what were you talking about?
Well, I mean, I think, like as I said before, that the fact that more intense greenhouse gases leads to higher temperatures, which then in turn will lead to probably more wildland fire. So if we don't get real about climate change and start dealing with climate change, which is the primary driver with that temperature feedback, then, you know, we continue to deal with the symptoms instead of the actual disease, if you will. So, I mean, what does that mean? Well, I think we have to globally get more serious about the Paris climate talks. Where's the meat on the bones in terms of what the commitments were made in Paris in December? How are each of the respective countries committing to meeting their targets, and are they on target for doing so? Are we doing the things that we can do in our respective countries, in Canada and the United States, in terms of trying to reduce our greenhouse gas intensity by transitioning to renewables, trying to move away from coal, transitioning to gas, which is less greenhouse gas intensive than coal, and trying to find some of these other paths in the transportation sector as well. So getting more efficient fuel economy standards in on vehicles, and trying to, you know, do more in terms of the many, many different ways that we can work to reduce our greenhouse gas intensities.
So in terms of forest fires then, is this a similar kind of feedback loop that reinforces and exacerbates the problems of global warming, as does, for example, the melting of the tundra that releases methane, that's a virulent greenhouse gas, and then you get this sort of cycle? So all of this, we've seen the pictures of these massive fires. Is all of that smoke adding to CO2 and greenhouse gas?
So I think what we worry about is in the forest is what's happening is that there's a lot of carbon stored in the trees. So when the trees burn, that carbon gets released into the upper atmosphere. So that's one form of that. And then because of the changing climate, we're seeing warmer temperatures in general. If the forest, the boreal forest, does burn catastrophically and then exposes that ground to more elements, so the peat soils that are up in the boreal forest are then exposed, and then they can begin to burn, or the permafrost begins to thaw. And so that starts another sort of vicious cycle of positive feedbacks in terms of climate change. So that would mean in some cases that methane would begin to be emitted into the atmosphere, and then that, you know, follows basically from the forests that have burned that have already released the carbon into the atmosphere. Now, we have to be a little bit careful about how we do that accounting, because forests can grow back, which would then restore the carbon. So in some cases, forests would begin growing back, and that then they would become carbon stores again. But if we see wholesale changes in those ecosystems due to the intensity of the way they were burned and rising temperatures, then we might not see that. So that does become a little bit more worrisome.
So we have spoken when these fires first started with some fire specialists who pointed out that there have been these fires in the past, and that they will continue to have them more with more frequency in the future because of global warming. But there was also a sense that this is a part of the cycle of nature, and that the forests refresh themselves. I asked about what happens to the wildlife, and most of the consensus seemed to be that most of the wildlife finds a way to escape it. So is that too rosy a picture that we've been told?
Well, what tends to happen, and this is a generalization, of course, it will be very specific depending on where it is. Small mammals and herps, so the snakes and those sorts of things, tend to bury in the ground if they can, and then they wait until the fire passes over top of them. Larger mammals will try to escape. Now, there's always going to be some casualties with wildlife in a fire, but in general, it's not usually catastrophic unless the fire is so big that the animals have no refuge. So fires like that tend to burn in what we call mosaics or patches, which usually leave some areas for animals and an escape, you know, route for them. And like you said, forest fires are a really important part of our ecosystems. Fire has evolved to play a natural role in many ecosystems. And the boreal forest is meant to burn catastrophically, usually depending on the species there, every 80 to say 200 years. So if it doesn't burn like that, it actually creates a less healthy forest environment. And it's sometimes harder for some species of animals. So after it burns, it tends to open up larger areas, which then allows grasses and other sorts of things and smaller shrubs to grow, which the critters eat. So that can actually lead to more robust wildlife populations if fire is allowed to play its more natural role.
Well, then, just in closing, Dr. Steelman, at the end of the day, when this fire is out, and it could take for a long time, and you're saying that essentially a weather event is the best possibility, and Canada seems to be extremely well prepared for these events, it's worth noting that, you know, a huge city was burned, a fifth of the houses were destroyed, and yet there were only two casualties, and they were from car accidents. So it seems to be, in that regard, being well handled. But what is the sort of national debate about now in terms of climate change, what causes climate change, and Canada's growing dependence upon its oil and gas sector, particularly there in Fort McMurray with the tar sands?
Sure. Well, I think what Fort McMurray has really woken us up to is that we need a wildland fire management strategy, and fortunately we actually have one. Canada actually has a really terrific strategy. It just hasn't been implemented and funded appropriately, or it's been implemented in a piecemeal fashion. And so I think Fort McMurray just basically becomes the latest poster child in what we call wildland urban interface fires in Canada that points to the need for us to have a more comprehensive wildland fire strategy. And then so I think post Fort McMurray and probably post fire season 2016, what we're really going to see is some discussion and debate about what we can do moving forward here in Canada related to that.
Well, Dr. Toddy Steelman, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Toddy Steelman, who's Executive Director and Professor at the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Saskatchewan, whose research interests include environmental and natural resource governance, public and community decision-making, the interface between science, policy and decision-making, climate change adaptation, disaster resilience communities, and risk and crisis communication and wildfire preparedness. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the 100th anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement as the map that divided up the Middle East between France and Britain at the end of World War I is in flames today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Paul, the author of Syria Unmasked. He was the executive director of the Global Policy Forum, a think tank that monitors the UN for nearly 20 years. He was also a longtime editor of the Oxford Companion to Politics of the World and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Paul.
Nice to be with you.
And this week marks the 100th anniversary since the Sykes-Picot Agreement between Britain and France that carved up the Middle East between them at the end of World War I, which was still going on at the time. And, of course, there was not there was duplicity amongst these two allies, even though they were fighting the Germans on the Western Front. They were jockeying for advantage in the Middle East. And of course, they just drew lines on a map, and that's the modern Middle East. But it's increasingly bears no resemblance to the current situation of chaos. So do you think this was going to all fall apart, or did George W. Bush and Dick Cheney give it a massive boost by the invasion of Iraq?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to just review a little bit about what Sykes-Picot was all about. I mean, yes, it was primarily negotiated by a French and a British diplomat. The Russians were involved in it, too, and the Russians were sort of a silent partner, but this was before the Russian Revolution. And so they were to get a slice of the Middle East, too. Most of Turkey, what is today Turkey, was dismembered, and the Turks later, under Ataturk, fought against that. And so there was quite a substantial change in the agreements that were reached by Sykes and Picot. And one of the major ones was that the Brits, being, let's say, more aware of the oil issues and their significance for war, kept on fighting at the very end of World War One. This is Sykes-Picot in 1916, May 16, 1916, and in 1918, after the armistice was declared, the British Indian Army that was fighting in what became Iraq continued to fight on up towards the north and west of the country, or what was to become the country of Iraq, and gained control of an area that they had already agreed with the French was to be part of the French zone of influence. So,
Of course, that area that you're talking about, Mosul, is where the oil is, and it's also where the Islamic State, or Daesh, is today, and where there's a battle going on to try and dislodge them from Iraq's second largest city, Mosul. So it's back in the news, if you will. But what is your understanding of why it is that all of the powers, you know, you talked about all the powers being involved in, well, at least the British and the French and the Sykes-Picot and the Russians were there as well, as they dismembered what was left of the Ottoman Empire. Why do they all insist on believing, for example, that Iraq is still a country? The Iranians want to maintain that myth. The Americans do, Europeans do, and the Russians do.
Well, there tends to be in diplomacy and in the real world a sense that when you start moving borders around, that leads to more problems than it solves. And I think we see that in the hubris of Sykes and Picot. At the time, we have to remember that the people living in those territories, you know, they're sometimes described generically as the Arabs, but of course there were many different peoples living there other than those who can be identified as Arabs, who were under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was ethnic Turks were the people who were running it at the time. So, The Europeans wanted to dismember the Ottoman Empire, saying that it was a terrible business that was ruining the lives of the people living in these other territories, and they wanted to help to liberate it. They had a sort of semi-modern language that they used in the highest levels of the British and French foreign service, and in the top politicians as well. We have to do something here for these people. And Woodrow Wilson himself, the American president, who is often regarded as some kind of nearly a saint, at least until recently when his racism has been revealed. He was pushing very hard for national self-determination in the Middle East and elsewhere. But when you start peeling away and really looking carefully at what's going on, these great powers didn't care about the national self-determination. They didn't care about the manner of rule of the people. They wanted to advance what they considered to be, and I would say it's then and now, so we can learn a lesson from the Sykes-Picot period. They wanted to advance certain geopolitical interests they had, and the Brits in particular were very aware of the oil interest, and the oil interest has continued right down to the present. Now, let's take a look at the more recent times, and I would propose that we look, in terms of Iraq, look at the issue of the Kurds. Of course, the Kurds are an important population element in several countries, including Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. And there is a claim that there should be either, considerable, federal devolution or an entirely new Kurdish state. And the Kurds have indeed been mistreated by a number of these governments. But the question is creating a new Kurdish state really such a good idea? And what other options are there? In fact, there are plenty of options short of trying to carve out a new state. And every time you go to carve out a new state, who's doing this? I mean, is this the Washington people in their wisdom are going to, start carving up again? They're always doing that sort of a thing. And it's part of sort of imperial hubris to imagine that you know better than anyone else how the world should be, where the border should be drawn.
Right, but there is a de facto Kurdish state in the north of Iraq. It is a fact. It's just not a recognized fact. The U.S. And the Europeans and the so-called coalition they have against Daesh, the Islamic State, with the exception of the Turks, of course, recognize that the only people that have been able to fight the Daesh, the Islamic State so far, have been the Kurds.
Right, but that doesn't mean necessarily, one way or another, whether or not if they have a fighting force, whether or not there should be a state. And also we have to look at what happens to the people inside of the borders of what is claimed to be the area of Kurdistan. You have other minorities. See, one of the problems with this sort of ethnic view of states, which is very common, it goes back to the late 19th century and to certain ideas about nationalism that subsequent to that time have been repudiated. And and that is that a state should be homogeneous in terms of ethnicity, language, and all that sort of thing. And so within the area of Kurdistan, we know from the recent news that there's all kinds of religious minorities there. And the Kurds, who are, seen by many to be, very wonderful people who are, better than their neighbors, and fight better mainly, but also, somehow are morally superior. They actually have not proved to be a very honest and reliable government in that zone over which they rule. And in fact, there's several different, it's almost possible to say that they're governed in terms of different competing warlords.
Right, the Barzanis and the Talibanis are basically...
Yes, exactly.
Basically,
so this doesn't look quite as the pro-Kurd people would like us to imagine.
Well, clearly, the Sykes-Picot Agreement
conflicted with pledges of freedom given to the British, and we know from Lawrence of Arabia that the Arabs got sold out in exchange for their support against fighting against the Turkey as the Ottoman Empire collapsed. And it also, of course, Sykes-Picot collided with U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's vision of self-determination for the people subjugated by the Ottoman Empire. But given what you're telling us, though, what's going on, though, is that instead of a vast sort of Arab country, if you will, what we've discovered as the Middle East unravels, and there's no question that Bush and Cheney took the cork out of the bottle by invading Iraq, and it's just continues to collapse daily. We're learning, for example, not just about the Kurds, we're learning about the Yazidis, we're learning in Syria about the Alawites, we're learning about the Houthis in Yemen. There are all kinds of peoples that have been sort of swept under the rug.
Yeah.
So what do you do about these people that basically have somehow survived on this land for centuries? Doesn't it make more sense to sort of, you know, let the chips fall?
Well, I don't know about let the chips fall. But you're right, it is important to understand the fact that this is a region that has a multiplicity of different peoples, and they've been there for a very long time, and they have a very old culture that should be respected. But I think we have to recognize that the imperial impulse to control these areas, and in particular the thirst for oil and the control over the region's oil resources. It's not an accident that this region is embroiled in constant war, because it has a resource that is, you know, worth a tremendous amount. And we may want to see a world that is past the oil era, but the oil companies know that they can produce oil in the Middle East, in many of the countries of the Middle East, at a cost of about $2 a barrel. And if they can sell that oil on world markets for $30, $40, or even $100, they make a gigantic profit. And they want to control that oil. And that means changing governments. It means pitting one group against another, and causing all sorts of trouble out there.
Right,
the Kurdish card is played again and again.
Sure.
By the Israelis, by the British intelligence, by the U.S., and so on. And that makes trouble for the Kurds.
Right, and the Norwegians actually are in there with getting the oil. But the Seven Sisters don't control that oil anymore. The Iranians control their own oil. The Saudis control Aramco.
I'm glad to speak to that, because they want to control that oil again. They did for the most part, up until the 1970s, when most of that Middle Eastern oil was nationalized. And that was the most valuable oil in the world, and they felt extremely upset and angry about losing their direct control of it that they had before in the concessions period. And so we can follow the development of U.S., British, and French foreign policy in the region, and military policy and so on, through an understanding that they want to overthrow the regimes, the nationalist regimes that control that oil, at the right time and in the right way, and to regain control for the companies. Now, in the case of Iraq, they saw that as being the best place to move. And it turned out that the Chinese, the French, and the Russians had made deals with Saddam Hussein to begin to privatize oil in their favor.
Sure.
And so when it came to the various votes in the UN Security Council, those three countries were opposed to any kind of military action. It was the U.S. and the U.K. that were completely frozen at their companies, namely Exxon, Chevron, and BP, and Shell, were frozen out of the Iraqi deals that were going on. Now, in order to understand what's happening in the Middle East, it's not only Iraq, including the issue of Kurdistan and the Kurdistan oil and all that, but also Iran. The recent business about the nuclear deal and so forth, the side agreements that were made with regard to the nuclear question in Iran had to do with oil and the semi-privatization of oil in Iran. And Saudi Arabia is in the process of also beginning to privatize its oil, and Libya. And so this is a very, very critical moment. And the idea that the place is melting down in the course of this sea change, which the people of the region wouldn't agree to, but now they can't because there's no really viable governments in most of those places. So we have to really keep the eye on the ball of oil in order to kind of see what's going on.
Sure, but we can't confuse the imperialist objectives of people like Dick Cheney and the neocons who thought this war was going to pay for itself with all this oil. And
yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's been a catastrophe. You can't discount incompetence. The motives may have been imperialistic, but the execution and the results have been a complete catastrophe. And none of those seven sisters control Iraq's oil to this day. And it's all being sort of stolen by that incredibly corrupt government that in Baghdad, and the Iranians have more influence than ever over Iraq. If anybody won the Iraq war, it was the Iranians.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to have to disagree with you. I think you're right up to a certain point. That is to say, they did not manage to impose a production sharing agreements, which were the type of oil regime that the Western companies wanted. They got things like that in Kurdistan, but they didn't get it in what is today the richest part of Iraq's oil resources, which is in the south. But I think the idea that, well, we're going to sit around in Washington with some people who pretend that they have the interests of the Iraqis in mind and draw some lines through a map just the way Sykes and Picot did.
Right.
And they thought they were doing everyone a favor, too, you know.
Sure. Well, James Paul, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Paul, who's the author of Syria Unmasked. He was executive director of the Global Policy Forum, a think tank that monitors the UN for nearly 20 years. He was also a longtime editor of the Oxford Companion to Politics of the World and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.